For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Everyone was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Yanto Ware was raised in the suburbs of Adelaide, in a house surrounded by a tangled garden of oak trees and vegetables. His family was a little different to the others in the street. His mum, Dimity, described herself as a radical, feminist, socialist lesbian. And apart from the family pets, it was just Yanto and Dimity at home. Yanto's written a book about growing up with his singular mum. It's called Mother and I, The Fable of a Willful Family. Hi, Yanto.
Hey, how are you?
I want to start with the van that your mum bought for herself when she was 60 or so. What did it look like?
So it was an ordinary Toyota Hiace van, secondhand, a bit battered. It had been used by a surveillance company before she bought it.
A surveillance company?
I'm not sure why, but it was, you know, secondhand, it's what she could afford. She had wanted to get a camper van because she had this dream of travelling around the country as a nomad, but she couldn't afford that, so she bought this battered former surveillance van with no seats in the back. I don't know what they do with surveillance, but it was just, the back was completely empty with this sort of foam mat. And then she declared that this was a camper van, filled it with she put a sort of foam mattress in there and a, you know, gas cooker and all of her camping equipment. And then one of her friends gave her a gigantic yellow canoe that she stuck on the top of the van, but she couldn't get it down. So she thought she'd use it to sort of, you know, drive to lakes and camp and boat around on the lakes, but she couldn't get the canoe off, so it kind of stayed up there.
What, more like a decoration?
So it was quite a, you know, I mean, this is suburban South Australia, and this, it was very, very obvious. And then I think over time, she wasn't a tidy person, so the van filled up with paper, and, you know, she was a teacher, so it filled up with all the things she was using in her classroom. And it was kind of like a, you know, like a travelling nest that just wandered around suburban South Australia.
Did she decorate the outside at all?
On the front, she had a rainbow-coloured sticker of in the silhouette of a cat. So she ripped off the car maker's logo and put that on the front. So it was pretty obvious when she was coming that there was this kind of eccentric lesbian charging through the neighbourhood.
What did she name this magnificent vehicle?
It was named by one of her friends. They called it the Van Dyke, which she thought was wonderful. She thought it was very funny.
So she bought this van with the dream of being a nomad. Where did she travel in it?
She did drive around quite a lot. So she would go up along the Riverland and out into the countryside. At one point when she got older, she actually drove to Alice Springs, and her friends wouldn't let her drive on her own, so she had a kind of driving companion. By that point, I mean, the van was, I don't know, 15, 20 years old. I'm surprised it got there, but it did. It was very, well, relatively reliable.
Were you allowed to drive at Yanto?
I learnt to drive in it. So one of the first things we did just after she first got it, she got it when she was younger. I think she was just about to turn 50. And we drove to Melbourne, and I learned to drive in this gigantic van. We went on a camping trip. I mean, she did quite adventurous trips. So we went up to Lake Mungo, and she was a very confident driver. So we were going down kind of, you know, sand roads, gravel roads, you know, a you know, two-wheeled kind of four-cylinder
with the canoe on top.
With the canoe on top. And, you know, we got bogged once. She decided, you know, we're going to go down this sort of back street and along the edges of we were in the Riverland, and it got bogged. And, I mean, she kind of loved minor disaster. So when things like that happened, she was thrilled. She'd, you know, get out the car and there'd be mud everywhere and her trying to push the van out of the mud, and wonderful.
Had your mum grown up in Adelaide?
Yeah, she grew up in the Adelaide Hills, so she had been born in 1952, and that was, you know, that era where after the war they zoned a lot of old farming and forest land for housing to try and generate cheap housing supply. And that's what her parents had bought. They bought a very cheap block of land in the Adelaide Hills with nothing on it. So it was just, you know, an area I think it had been used mostly for forestry. There was no other houses there when they moved up there. There was no sewerage.
So did they build a house themselves there then?
Yeah, they were 17, 18, and they kind of went up there and they didn't have any mechanical equipment, so they just kind of carved down through the hill themselves with pickaxes and then used the rock from the hill to help build the house. They built one section of the house first, and then all through my mother's childhood they were slowly building on to bits of the house.
As teenagers, that's so young. Why did they marry so young?
So my grandparents had grown up in a sort of weird Methodist offshoot called the Cooneyites, which neither of them liked. They were both quite, you know, they were free spirits and they didn't like the restrictions of the Cooneyite faith. They met when they were quite young. They met when I think they were sort of 12, 13. The family origin story is that my grandmother was sitting behind my grandfather in church and the Methodist preacher was droning on and she got bored. So she was looking at the boil on the back of my grandfather's neck and somehow that was the beginning of their romance. Yeah. Yeah. And then they, you know, my grandmother says they ended up getting pregnant because the church had forbidden them from doing any of the things churches or children usually get to do. So all the normal teenage activities were forbidden to them, so they kind of thought they invented sex.
They couldn't go to the movies or dancing, so they fornicated instead.
Yeah, that's kind of what happened. I mean, they were very deeply in love from very early on, and when they had the first child, my eldest uncle at 15, I think there was a real threat that the church would take the baby away, and they were very determined to stop that happening. And, you know, my grandfather dropped out of his apprenticeship and went and got a job, and they somehow, you know, sort of borrowed from their parents, I think, to buy this block of land and kind of broke away from the church and formed their own little world.
So they created this little world, building a house themselves out of stone on this block of land, and had your older uncle and then your mum came along. What did they realise about her health after she was born?
So shortly after she was born, they realised that she was not well, and they found she had something wrong with her kidneys. So she had a kind of renal infection that caused one of her kidneys to die and the other one stopped working or begun to fail. And that got progressively worse, I think, from about the age of two up until when she was 11 and she had to have surgery.
What did it mean when she was a little girl having this non-functioning kidney when she was two or three? What did that mean for the family?
I mean, it was a lot of stress because there was points that they didn't think she was going to survive, and, you know, the two people in their very early 20s trying to take care of a very sick child who had very little money and not necessarily that much family support around them. So my grandmother was taking my mother down to hospital more or less every couple of days and taking my aunt, who was 2 years younger, down with her. So it kind of defined their lives quite a bit, that early sickness. So there was a lot of, I think they felt there's a lot of fear and tension amongst my mother, my aunt and my grandmother, that they were all going to the hospital every day. In my mother's diary, she wrote about this very early memory when she was three or four of being left in the hospital overnight and watching her mother walk out and feeling that she was being abandoned, which of course she wasn't. My grandmother fought with the hospital staff to try and make sure they had very good care. But as a three-year-old, I don't think my mother really understood that. And it sort of set up this bit of tension between them.
And of course, that was the era where parents were encouraged to leave their children in hospitals alone. So what was the surgery that she had at 11?
So when she was 11, they sort of thought she was going to die and they didn't really know what to do, but they had I think it was an expert who'd just come back from London, studying in London, who was an expert in renal health. And they said, we've kind of got this experimental surgery. They sent her off to have this surgery and she inexplicably survived. I mean, they thought, well, it's a last ditch effort, but let's try it. So she went off, had this surgery. She was very ill for probably the next year. I think she was held back at school, which she strongly resented because she loved school. And then over the course of the summer, when she was recovering from the surgery, she started keeping diaries. She'd read Anne Frank and started keeping diaries ever after.
As a child then, Yanto, did she think of herself as an invalid, as someone frail?
I think she saw her illness as something that she had conquered and that she was fighting against. So she saw herself as being very strong, but she struggled a lot with being perceived as being kind of a weak, frail infant. And you look at pictures of her as a child, particularly around that time when she's 10, 11, 12, 13, and she does look frail. She looks very, very thin. She looks pale. Her younger sister outgrew her. She was held back at school for a year and felt that she was being treated like she was stupid and weak. Her character was always going to be strong, but I think that sense of having a self-perception that she was a very powerful person whilst being treated like she was a very weak person gave her a certain kind of fire.
Hmm. And it could well have set up a bit of conflict with her parents too. I think if you've had sick child, you're always fearful for them and extra protective of them. Hmm. Is that the case with your mum and her parents?
My grandmother was very, very protective. And I think, you know, you can imagine a mother in the 1950s being told by doctors, you know, there's nothing you can do here, go away, go home, we'll deal with it, you know, how frightening that would have been. And my grandmother basically responded with pure rage and became incredibly like a sort of she-wolf protectiveness, which my mother took the other position that, you know, she was going to take care of herself. But I think the tension between them was actually really productive. It meant they had a lot of kind of fights over things that were sort of ciphers for the illness. So they would have a massive fight over my mother's a very messy person, or was a very, very messy person. My grandmother's very clean. And they'd have fights over the dishes or the state of my mother's room as a way of handling that tension. Mm. But I think it allowed both of them to maintain this sense that through sheer force of will, they could conquer the threat of my mother's health.
Well, she recovered from that surgery at 11 and went on and finished high school. What did she do after she left school?
So my grandparents encouraged her to go on and do a teaching diploma, which I think was quite rare at that time. I don't think that many girls from working class backgrounds had gone into the skilled professions, but they pushed both of their daughters to go on, and my aunt became a librarian, my mother became a teacher. She absolutely loved studying. She also loved the kind of, you know, we're talking early 70s kind of college environment where she, I think that's where she encountered feminism for the first time, that she encountered activism for the first time. She got very excited about, you know, this is early days of second wave feminism, and that sort of set her up for the future.
Who did she meet? Who was the man that she met at college?
She also met my father and got married, which is very unusual given the rest of her life. She was a very devout lesbian, but, I mean, she said that she got married because she thought it was compulsory, that that's just what you had to do to become an adult. And she thought she would almost do what my grandparents had done. You know, she would get married, she would buy a house, and that house would become her own weird little world where she could do whatever she wanted. And then found that, you know, the constraints of being a kind of housewife, even though she was working and my father was, he was quite a nice guy, that was not the life she wanted.
What did your dad's family think about him marrying your mum?
I think both my father's family and my mother's family, particularly my grandmother, thought that they were too young and it was a terrible idea. And maybe my grandmother could see that my mother was not going to be the get married, settle down type of person and tried to discourage her. My father's grandmother, I think at one point she said, you know, if you don't get married, maybe I could buy you a stereo or something. Because he was very young. He was a boy. He was 19. But they decided, you know, well, okay, look, they're telling us this, but, you know, who listens to your parents? They decided they were going to have a sort of trial period before they got married. So they went and rented this house and said, okay, if this goes well, you know, if we can live together, we'll get married after that. So they rented this house in suburbs in Adelaide, as far away from the rest of their family as they could find it, and moved in together. Neither of them did any housework because my mother thought housework was sort of politically incorrect, and my father just didn't really know how, and, you know, he was a 19-year-old boy. So the house was absolutely filthy and full of junk, and they got these two dogs and they had cats, and, you know, the dogs dig everything up and tread mud everywhere. And, you know, my mother was into gardening, but, you know, the garden was sort of coming in and out of the house. There's a story I was told growing up where my father was a sort of musician and he had a drum kit set up, and their cat would climb into the kick drum and urinate.
Oh.
And every day they would hear the sound of the cat spraying on the drum skin, and that would sort of reverberate through the house. Eventually the landlords kicked them out after about 6 months. And they said this was because the landlords were conservatives that didn't like unmarried couples. But, I mean, you can imagine, just didn't want their house destroyed.
So they were trying to create their own version of what marriage might be. But what did your mum write in her diary on their second wedding anniversary? How were things for her in that marriage?
I mean, she found being married very dull. She didn't like the sense of being conventional. And I think she found my father's expectations. I mean, I don't think he pressured her to be, you know, he wasn't conventional, but he also wasn't reading feminist theory, and he didn't really see that he should be doing the housework or things like that. So she wrote in her diary that she had become a radical, and she did become a radical in a way, that she started reading, you know, more and more feminist theory. She and my grandmother started going to, you know, women's liberation meetings together. And I think through that, she started meeting lesbians and realizing that that was a possibility, that, you know, you didn't have to be a heterosexual, which was quite unique at the time, because this would have been just around the same time homosexuality was being legalized in South Australia. I think Don Dunstan had come into power, so he was the first premier in Australia to legalize homosexuality. You know, the law had changed, but the social stigma and the bigotry was still there. But I think in that era, you know, my mother began to see that maybe there were alternative ways of living, and that she didn't have to just, you know, have a husband and be a housewife and live this sort of conventional, normal life that seemed laid out for her.
What was happening with her health at this stage?
She got progressively more and more ill as she got older. So they had hoped that the surgery she had when she was 11 had cured her, but by, I think, sort of 22, 23, it was clear it hadn't. When she got married, she was already sort of quite, you know, chronic illness makes you quiet and weak, and it holds you down. And I think she went into the marriage maybe not able to be fully who she was because she was so sick. As she got more and more ill, so her kidney broke down and couldn't clean her blood properly, and that made her even quieter and more repressed, to the point that she had to stop working, and she was going in to have dialysis to have her blood kind of mechanically cleaned every couple of days. And her whole life kind of just became about being sick, until she reached a point where she got almost too ill to do anything, went in to have the dialysis one day, and this was in 1976, I think. And she noticed the nurses were kind of whispering. And then one of the doctors came in and said, "You're going to have a kidney transplant today." And they wheeled her off, and she had a kidney transplant.
Did she know who she was, whose kidney she was having?
We don't know. We think it was, there was a newspaper report of a young man who died in a motorbike accident the day before. So we think it was possibly him. I mean, it's the kind of thing I've often wondered, because it would be lovely to tell his family that, you know, his death gave my mother 40 years of life.
40 years. Well, what was the prognosis in the 70s for a kidney transplant?
So there was three other people having kidney transplants when she went in. The other two both died within a month. I think one of them died. He caught pneumonia, I think, and that killed him. The other one, I think the kidney just failed. And my mother knew her quite well. They were in sort of adjoining rooms, and my mother could hear her dying over the course of a night. And then, so you didn't live. Her doctors told her, after she was still alive a month later, "We think you probably have about 10 years. And she, my grandmother has this story of about 3 months after the transplant, when it was, you know, clear that she wasn't going to die immediately, and she was starting to feel stronger again. And they went walking down Frome Street in Adelaide, and it was autumn. And my mother said to my grandmother, "You know, I've been very sick, haven't I?" And my grandmother said, "Yes, you have." And then my mother kicked through all these leaves and said, "But I'm not sick now." And then that sort of began the period of her kind of breaking away from the marriage and becoming, I think, the person I grew up with.
She met a woman named June around this time. Tell me about her and what you know about that relationship.
So she met her on a camping trip. There was all these sort of women's lib camping trips where they'd go off and, and, you know, consciousness raising and read theory and talk to each other. So I met her on one of these camping trips just after the transplant. In her diary, she writes, one night they, you know, just kind of, I think they just sort of kissed and laid together in a tent. And then the next night, my mother consummated her lesbianism and kind of went back to my father and said, you know, this has happened. And he was sort of weirdly supportive. He admitted he'd had his own affairs. I think he also, you know, he told her later on that he wanted her to be happy. And that, you know, it was the 70s. I think there was an idea that, you know, you can have open marriages now. You'll still be married, but it won't be a conventional marriage. So they decided that's what they'd try and do, is have this sort of open, unconventional marriage, which I think maybe she was ready for. I don't think he was ready for. I think he found it very upsetting. But she had this lunch where she got June and my father to sit down together. And in her diary, she says, I had a lovely time. But yeah, I don't know what they thought of it.
What would she tell you years later about jacaranda trees? Why was that a time of year that was nostalgic for her?
So when she realised she had fallen in love with a woman, it was October, November in Adelaide, which is the season the jacarandas came out. So she always associated jacarandas with this sort of birth of her new life and this beginning of this point of realising who she was and realising that, not just that she was lesbian, but that she was not going to die of a kidney problem, that she was going to go out and do something else. So whenever I was growing up, we'd always be taken to see the jacarandas, and it would always be explained, you know, the jacarandas were in bloom when I first fell in love with the woman, and I realised that, you know, I wasn't going to just be another person sitting in their suburban house all my life.
That relationship with June didn't continue. But she did.
She decided
to leave your father and live independently. Yeah. But what happened in the 2 months it took her to find a place to live by herself?
So she had a very amicable breakup with my father.
Very amicable.
Very, very amicable. Such that about 3 weeks after she left him, she realised she was pregnant with me. And when I went through her diaries after she died, I found the diaries around the time she realised she was pregnant, and you can see her going back through figuring out what the date of conception would be. And it would have been, I think it was her birthday, about a week before she left, a week before she moved out. So they'd agreed to break up, and I think I was the very last gasp of her heterosexuality. absolute fluke. And then she moved out and, yeah, had me, yeah.
Was being pregnant risky to her health, given that history?
I mean, when she found out she was pregnant, she told my aunt, first of all, and then she told her doctors, and her doctor said, you've had a kidney transplant. If you have a child, you will probably die, and the child will probably die. A year before she left my father, she'd had a miscarriage, which she blamed on the medication she was taking for the kidney transplant. So when she found out she was pregnant with me, and this is when she was living by her own in a little rental place in Adelaide, she told the doctors that she was going ahead with the pregnancy and then halved her medication without telling them, which, I mean, the risk of that is that you have the organ rejects and you die. But she just decided, this is what I'm doing. I think because she'd been told you're going to die before, she sort of thought, well, it comes down to if I want to live, I'm going to live. She didn't initially tell my grandmother because she knew my grandmother would be absolutely furious. When it reached a point where she sort of had to tell my grandmother, she delegated the task to my aunt and sent my aunt up to visit my grandmother in the hills. And it did not go well. My grandmother was absolutely furious. There was a, you know, because she, you know, she saw this as my mother taking this huge risk that was, you know, highly likely to kill her. But eventually I was born, and, you know, I think my mother saw it as a bit of a victory that she, you know, she had taken on this risk. She had realised that she was lesbian. She had forged ahead to be her own person. And then I think she sort of saw me as a bit of an immaculate conception, that she had produced this child out of nowhere and no one could tell her what to do.
Can you, Yanto, read out her diary entry from when you were just 3 days old?
Yes, I can. Just let me find it. So, I mean, when I was born, she had an emergency cesarean. So the first couple of days afterwards, she was quite groggy and didn't really know what was going on. And then on, the third day, she was given me to hold and she was awake enough to know what was going on. And then the day after that, she wrote, "Good morning, it's February 4th and I have a three-day-old son. He has character to my amazement. He talks and cries, waves his hands and likes to be awake and watching things. He is curious, which to me is lovely. He even smiles, though they tell me it is wind. He is to be named Yanto."
Were there many families like yours on the street that you grew up?
No, there were not. There were no families like mine. I mean, you know, when I was born, I think the first IVF baby had been born about a month before, but it was, I think it was another 10 years before lesbian women could access IVF. At that point, I mean, homosexuality had just been legalized. There weren't that many people who were living openly as gay and lesbian. So it was a very unconventional life. And it hadn't reached a point where people, you know, who had come out had also had children. Just completely unheard of.
And not only was your mother a lesbian, she was also a single mother. And how were single mums talked about back in the 70s and 80s?
Pretty horribly. I mean, this was the era where you had Reagan and Thatcher had just come in, and I think that sort of set the political tone for the time. So people were talking about, you know, welfare queens and blaming broken homes for the decline of Western civilization. And there was a lot of stigma and bigotry and bias, which we felt acutely growing up. So she had this particular Salvation Army store that we never went to, because when I was about a year old, we'd gone there. And the lady working there had asked if I was a mistake and asked if my mother regretted me. And she picked up on that, you know, all the time, this kind of residual sense that being a single mother made you a kind of a moral failure. And this sense that single mothers can't raise children. And if they do, particularly if they raise boys, that those boys will grow up to be kind of criminals and degenerate and terrible human beings.
So was it a bit of a case of you and her against the world?
Oh, very much so, yeah. You know, my grandmother and my aunt were incredibly supportive and came over and took care of me and, you know, helped out. But my mother saw herself as being this, you know, kind of lone crusader. And I thought of her like that, that she always seemed so strong, and the world she built for us in our kind of suburban quarter-acre block always felt so safe. But and then there was this world around us that seemed to have a lot of people who, for reasons I didn't really understand, weren't particularly fond of us.
Yeah, so your mum managed to buy a house. Do you remember moving in?
I do remember moving in. It was a momentous occasion. So she had sold the house. My parents had a house, or they had, you know, part of a house. They had a mortgage. And they sold that, and then she used the down payment from that to buy the house I grew up in, which was, I mean, it wasn't a great house, and it certainly wasn't in a great neighbourhood. She had looked at a lot of houses because she wanted me to have a stable sense of home. And I think she also didn't think she'd live for very long. So she bought this house thinking, well, you know, when I die, Yunto will have this asset and it will give him a bit of safety and security. So she looked at houses for a while. All the ones she could afford were pretty bad. She bought the one I grew up in because it had very good soil quality. And she knew she could grow a massive garden there and create this little, yeah,
tell
world
me,
just for us.
Tell me about the garden that your mother created. Walk me through it. What would I have seen?
So when we first moved in, it was like any other quarter-acre block in any other kind of down-at-heel suburb. So it had a lawn. It had a couple of ornamental trees. There were some fruit trees out the back, but it was mostly lawn. And then as soon as she moved in, she started ripping up the lawn, and we would go to, you know, school fetes or the, you know, the bargain bins at the garden shops, and she would get all sorts of ground cover and trees and plants and then just jam them into the soil. And then she got some nasturtiums from my grandmother's house and scattered those everywhere until it reached a point after we'd been there a few years that it was effectively impenetrable. So if you didn't know the path to walk through it, you probably couldn't walk through it. So we would have, you know, salespeople come through, or like, you know, Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses would try to get into the yard and just kind of get stuck and have to retreat. Because she was, I mean, she was only, I think she was 5'2". So the garden was kind of, it had sort of tunnels running through the foliage at 5'2". And if you were above that, it didn't work that well. You'd bump into things. Yeah, we had a cat that used to sit in the low-hanging branches, and people would walk in and it would swipe at their heads as they went past.
It sounds like a magical place for a kid. Did you spend a lot
great.
Of time in the garden?
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot like you know, Christopher Robin, the 100-acre wood, but more just like a quarter-acre block. So I used to take my, I've still got him, a teddy bear called Tubby. And Tubby and I would go off and we'd spend the day building, you know, cubbies around the place. And because we had all these fruit trees, so I'd just go out there and gorge on mandarins all day or apricots all day, depending on what was in season, build these cubbies. Yeah, it was a great place to grow up. I think it was just, you know, when I had to leave the house, it tended to get hard. But within the house and the garden, it was, yeah, it was absolutely lovely.
Were you lonely for playmates in that garden, or were you happy with yourself and Tubby?
Tubby and I were pretty happy together. And I think my mother worried I wasn't socialising, which is true. I wasn't socialising. And you know, when she went back to work, she took me to the local daycare that was attached to the teacher's college, so the creche there. You know, I thought it was a complete interruption to my day. I didn't understand why I had to play with these other boys and girls and why I had to socialise. And I would go there with Tubby, and kind of Tubby and I would go off and do our own thing and all the other children would be playing something else. And then I would usually just go and, you know, in the afternoon after I'd had the afternoon snack, just wait for my mother to come and pick me up. And then I'd go back to the garden, and I thought it was great.
You survived creche and made it onto to primary school. Tell me about the portrait you drew for Mother's Day.
So when I was five, we had to draw a picture of our mothers because it was, you know, Mother's Day was coming up, and told you, you know, paint a picture of your mothers and give it to your mothers. And I painted my mother, who, you know, I think I've still got the picture. She kept it and I found it after she died. It's her in her overalls with her short hair, looking like a kind of early 1980s lesbian. And the other children were just outraged. It's like, that's not a picture of a mother. You're meant to draw a picture of your mother. And we had this long debate around, well, what does a mother look like? And they're like, you know, a mother wears dresses and a mother has long hair. And I kept saying, but that's not, you know, she doesn't look like that. And then eventually I relented. I made her hair a little bit longer. So I looked at the picture when I found it after she died, and you can see where I've got the brown crayon and sort of extended the hair half a centimetre. And they sort of accepted that, but I thought I'd done a terrible job and I'd sort of, you know, compromised my artistic integrity. My mother loved it. She didn't realise I'd done that.
Yeah. Were other parents wary of your family? I mean, even if you weren't conscious of that at the time, can you see it now?
Yeah, I think the parents and some of the teachers, partly because she was working and they didn't like the idea of a working mother. When I started school, she'd asked if there was a before school care program and was told very, very bluntly, no, there is no before school support here. I had a friend when I was about five or so, so just after I started school, and we had little play dates, and then she was no longer allowed to come to my house. And my mother later told me that her parents had figured out that my mother was lesbian and thought that she would molest their daughter, so she couldn't come to the house anymore. I mean, I wasn't aware of that, but I was aware that people were judging our family. I don't remember my mother ever saying, don't tell people that your mother is lesbian, but I always knew it was a risk to do that. I didn't start talking to people about my family until, I mean, I was in my probably early mid-20s before I started, you know, openly saying my, you know, my mother is lesbian.
Was your mum worried about you as a little kid in terms of just that social stuff and your confidence with other children?
Yeah, I think because she had been so sociable and she was so, you know, charging headlong into things, she was quite almost annoyed to have such a nervous, kind of retiring, quiet little boy, you know, that I just wanted to play with Tubby all the time. And she sort of blamed it on my grandmother. She's like, you know, he's inherited the antisocial gene from you, because my grandmother's, yeah, not a hugely social person. And she would sort of say, you know, if the other children at his school are less interesting than his toy bear, then that's their problem. Like, it's not up to him. Yeah.
She went and saw a psychologist. And what did they advise her to do?
She went and saw a psychologist because she was worried about me not fitting in, and I had a lot of trouble. When I started school, you know, she would leave me at the school gates and I would just kind of stand there and cry and then go running through the hall screaming with fear every day, which she found pretty draining and annoying. And they sent her away to kind of do a list of the things that she thought was positive about being a single mother, because I think she just, you know, like a lot of single mothers, you're constantly being told you're doing a bad job and maybe not getting a lot of affirmation, and they wanted her to get in the habit of giving herself affirmation for the things she's doing well. So she went home and she wrote this list that reads, which is in one of her diaries, so I found it afterwards, and it reads, we belong to each other. There is no room for any bullshit. There are no barriers, so we have to be totally honest. I like that. He is one of the few people who wants me to be myself, not out of love for me, but because as an only child of an only parent, he is vulnerable and needs to know exactly how things are. So I read that list in her diary just after she died, probably about 2 weeks afterwards, and it was pretty emotional to see how she saw our relationship at that point. I think it's hard for me to figure out how my family differs from your kind of your quote-unquote normal families. And I haven't met that many families that would say all that normal. Everyone seems to be unique in their own way. But it did articulate something. I think, you know, that single parent, only child relationship is very close, that we became very, very good friends. I think for us to feel that our family was secure. There had to be a lot of kind of trust and cooperation between us that maybe isn't always the same in, you know, larger families where you're not so reliant on each other.
Did you go on holidays together? Was there life outside of work and traumatic schooling?
She was very big on taking me out on camping trips and holidays. She would drive us out into the country with the dogs and we would go camping up along the, you know, the York Peninsula or up into the Adelaide Hills. The first year of primary school, in that summer holidays, we went up and did a great big driving trip along the River Murray and went from town to town to town. And it was a real, I think, awakening for me because, you know, growing up in the suburbs, it felt like the whole world was just a suburb. And we went up there and, you know, she was showing me, I remember seeing, you know, walking through these sand dunes and seeing the remnants of what must have been Aboriginal camps that they must have been hundreds of years old. And her explaining, you know, there was this kind of society here before British got here. And these people lived in this completely different way. And us talking through what had happened to that world and me coming back with a very different perspective, you know, thinking, you know, I live in these suburbs, but it hasn't always been like this, and it won't necessarily always be like this, and finding that quite striking.
You mentioned before that your mum was quite up for things going wrong, which in my experience of camping is basically what happens. Did things ever go haywire on those camping trips?
I think she loved the elements of camping where things go horribly wrong, like where the car gets bogged, or we had this amazing trip. I think it was the end of that trip up along the Murray, and we ended up kind of driving back, and then we stayed somewhere along the coast, I don't know where, but the place was completely deserted. It was just us, and she set the tent up right next to the beach, and then this massive storm came in, and it was huge. It was pelting down. There was this sort of, you know, kind of crackling lightning that lights up the whole sky, and I was there cowering because I was a small, nervous little boy, but she loved it, and eventually the tent blew over, and she kind of clambered out, and I stayed there cowering, And then after a while, I thought, you know, she's out there and, you know, maybe she's not okay. Maybe I need to go out and help her. Kind of tentatively stuck my head out the canvas flap. And I could see her sort of pulling the guidelines of the tent back into place. And then she pulled the last one in and hammered it in. And then simultaneously, she raised her arms in sort of victory. And this massive crack of lightning came down in the distance behind her and lit up the whole sky. And then the rain just stopped. And it's an image I always associate with her because it's so kind of mythological, like this sort of powerful force who controls the weather and then, you know, goes out and, you know, resurrects the campsite and stops the storm for me.
What about your dad, Yanto? Was he in your life much when you were growing up?
So the first 2 years after I was born, I didn't see my father at all. And then when I was two, I realised there was this thing called fathers. I'd seen them on television. And I asked my mother, you know, do I have one of those? So she arranged for us to meet, and I met him. And apparently after the first meeting, I said, I didn't like him. Could I have another one? But every year after that, we usually see him sort of Christmas and birthdays. And he was very sweet. He was a lovely guy. He was very funny, but he wasn't a father. I'd see him a couple of times a year. And then he died when I was 10. He had an aneurysm of the brain, so he was kind of fine in the morning and then just dead in the afternoon.
How did you find out?
So I was sitting in class, and it was the end of the day, at the end of the term, and my mother and my grandmother appeared at the door to the classroom and took me out of class, and then we walked back to my grandmother's car, and my mother and I sat in the back seat, and my mother said, you know, your father's dead, and she burst into tears. She was very, very upset.
Did you go to his funeral?
So we went to the funeral, and I remember sitting with her, and he had two other children by that point, and he'd remarried. And the funeral service was probably understandably mostly about them. I don't think they mentioned my mother and I. And then afterwards I walked out, and I began to think about, you know, she had been far more likely to die than he had been. And I began to think about how much my life would have changed if it had been her funeral I was attending. I was 10 and I knew we would lose the house, we would lose the garden. I didn't know what would happen to me. You know, I mean, I love my mother so much that idea that I would lose her and we would lose the life that she had built for us absolutely terrified me. For weeks and, you know, months after that, I would worry that she'd been killed in a car crash or something. I'd be at school thinking, you know, my grandmother's going to turn up any minute and take me out of the classroom and say, your mother has died, and have these sort of nightmares of this one night that I remember really acutely, where my mother and I were driving up to visit my grandmother, and we saw our car burnt out on the side of the road. And then when we got up to my grandmother's house, my mother went into another room and I talked to my grandmother, and my grandmother said, "Your mother is dead." And I went looking for her and couldn't find her. And, you know, this, I think that dream was almost as bad as the actual death of my father. Like, it was so upsetting.
You didn't really have a relationship with your father, but were there other men that your mum tried to get you to build a relationship with?
As I got older and my mother could see me being even more of an eccentric little boy, she began to worry that I was going to have trouble when I had to mix with other boys in high school. So she spoke to my... I mean, she tried a few things. She tried sending me to Boy Scouts, which was terrible. I hated it. They let me quit because I cried in one of the meetings. So then she talked to my grandmother, and my grandmother said, "Well, your grandfather's just retired and he's kind of annoying me at the moment, so why don't we leave Yonto with him?" And it was wonderful. My grandfather was a lovely man. And I think, you know, when he was working, he'd always been a very kind of, he'd always been a bit stern. And then when he retired, I think he could relax. And this very sort of sweet man came out, and he began to do all the things he hadn't been able to do during his life because he'd had to work so much. He was really into gems and minerals and the natural world. He took to painting all these stones and rocks and plants, and would do these detailed microscopic oil paintings of rock structure. So they would leave me with him. And I think my mother and my grandmother went off to a community dance class together, and they went off and had fun. And I would stay up at the house with him, and he would take me down to his workshop, and we'd spend usually a couple of hours with him explaining some incredibly detailed piece of, you know, engineering history or kind of industrial, you know, manufacturing history. So I remember this 2-hour essay, you know, this soliloquy he delivered on how they make copper. And it went from, this is how they mine the rock, this is how the rock gets formed, this is how they smelt it. I had no idea what was going on. I just stood there for 2 hours. And then we would always play chess. And for some reason, I was much better at chess than him. And he wasn't the kind of man who would let a small child beat him. But I think I won, it's about 14 games in a row.
So did this relationship with your lovely granddad offer the kind of protective film that your mum hoped it would once you got to high school?
I think in the long term, he was a wonderful role model. And I can certainly see how a lot of my behaviours today mimic the things that he taught me. Like, he had this amazing kind of cross-disciplinary approach to knowledge, that you try to learn lots of different things and you don't just stay in one discipline. You try and think across things. But, you know, that kind of, that guy painting microscopic images of rocks and gum leaves was not a good indicator of what kind of teenage masculinity was like at a kind of working class school in the early 1990s. No, it was quite an abrupt shock.
Did school feel dangerous, Yonto?
It felt, yeah, incredibly dangerous. I don't know how much that was just me being frightened. I mean, I don't think the school was that much worse than any other comparable kind of lower socioeconomic school. But, I mean, I didn't really know, you know, I hadn't grown up with this idea of this is how you're meant to become a man. And then watching these teenage boys figure out how they were meant to be as men, I found them a real shock. And it was really hard trying to figure out how I was meant to fit in with them. The things I remember most about school is there was always this kind of threat of getting beaten up. You know, boys were always threatening to beat each other up. And also just the almost constant homophobia. Like, I think probably from the age of 13 through to 23 or so, I doubt a week went past without another boy or young man telling me that I was a faggot and they were going to kick my head in. And, you know, I think that's quite common for a lot of men. But for me, it was, you know, I'd never encountered that kind of behaviour. So I found it quite scary.
Did it change the way you acted with your mum?
I mean, I remember having this very acute sense that it was all right for her to live in this sort of wonderful lesbian gardening oasis, but I had to go out into a world of men who acted like this and were, you know, angry and getting drunk on the park outside the school and beating each other up. And I sort of kind of resented her for it. I don't know what I thought she could do, but I thought, you know, I'd always assumed that she would be able to protect me from everything. And now I found this world where it didn't sound like that there was very much she could do. And that probably, we had a very difficult relationship for a couple of years when I was in school, as I gradually came to the realization I didn't have to be like those boys, that there were alternatives. But that was a very hard realization to come to.
After the end of high school and after you'd left home, do you think your mum was lonely without you there?
I think she'd always wanted to, you know, have her own life and live on her own. I think she kind of enjoyed, I mean, I only moved a suburb over, so she still saw me all the time. But I think part of her enjoyed that sense of she got to live exactly as she wanted. But I think she kind of missed having somebody to take care of. I think it kind of made her feel stronger. She'd never had girlfriends growing up when I was a child. I think the last time she'd been in a relationship, I was only two or three. And she had another relationship after I moved out. I mean, they had a lot of fun. It didn't work out in the sort of longer term.
Who was Arthur who came and lived with her?
So after she had broken up with her girlfriend and after I had become an adult, and when I became an adult, I became a relatively competent adult. So she
against
had that,
all expectations.
Certainly against my expectations. So she wanted somebody to take care of. So she went to the pound and got this just unbelievably nervous little dog who she called Arthur. And probably she'd had him for about 2 weeks before she started confusing the two of us. So she'd ring me up and say, oh, I took Yonto for a walk and he lost his tennis ball and I had to clamber into the river to get the tennis ball out for him. And he was like a version of me that was in dog form. He was very anxious. He was completely adoring of her. He completely trusted her, would follow her around. But you know, like she took him everywhere, particularly as she got older and she couldn't work so much. Arthur was her constant companion and they would go camping together and they'd go to the shops together. And we'd go out to dinner and I'd say, maybe you shouldn't take Arthur to dinner with us. And she'd say, no, he gets lonely and he wants to come with us. So Arthur would come with us.
Well, she had Arthur and you were moving out into your own life. How did you first meet Diana, the woman who you're now married to?
I met Diana. She was doing a performance art piece where she was throwing up on herself as part of the Adelaide Fringe in 2011.
I can't help but be reminded of your grandmother falling in love with the grandfather through the boil. This seems to be a trait in your family.
Yeah, just seeing another kind of eccentric character out there is always quite nice.
I'm terrified to ask, but how is she making herself throw up on herself in this performance art piece?
So it was this performance art piece that was based on this kind of complex critique of the way comedy works, and they did these sort of surrealist reenactments. So there's four of them, including her. And one of the things they did was this thing called the magic trick, where they would make bananas disappear by eating them. So they just eat bananas until they threw up. And they would do that for like 4 hours at a time. And I went with a friend of mine who was producing the show, and I remember just watching it thinking, what on earth is this? And then I went back the next night and watched it some more. And the other thing they were also dressed as dunces. So my future wife was dressed as sort of a green dunce. She had a great big dunce cap on and this sort of black overalls with a green bib covered in banana vomit. And it was basically love at first sight. I'm sure she'll love me telling this story on national radio.
How did your mum and Diana get on the first time you introduced them?
I think my mother struggled a bit. My mother would come to visit me and Di when we were in Sydney. And Di's from Sydney originally. And she would... Di's very tidy. And my mother sort of thought that it was kind of a bit of a feminist liberation to encourage Di to be less tidy. So she would come over and kind of deliberately mess up the house and move things around and knock things over. And she had this amazing capacity to accumulate sand and used tissues. So when she came to visit our incredibly clean little house, you'd see this trail of sand and used tissues going from all the places she'd sat, which Di was very polite, but it created some tension.
Your mum had defied all the doctor's expectations since she was a little girl, but a few years ago she began getting frailer and complications from her kidney transplant meant she was having to spend more and more time in hospital. What did she ring to tell you?
You know, she rang me up and said, you know, this isn't living, I'm going to stop taking all the medication. And that was effectively, you know, that was the decision that she was going to die, which... I mean, it sounds strange, but looking back at it now, I'm quite glad that she was able to make a decision. And then I flew back to spend the last week with her. She'd asked one of the nurses, you know, how long is this going to take? I've stopped taking the medication. How long before I get to die? And they said, you know, how long do you want? And she said, about a week should do it for me. And they said, well, don't underestimate the power of your own will in these things. And, yeah, it was a week later she died. She wasn't in any pain because, the one upside of kidney failure is it's not a painful death. She just grew tireder and weaker and slept more and more and more until at the end, I mean, I was with her when she died, sitting next to her holding her hand, and she just stopped breathing and that was it.
What happened to your mum's house, Yanto?
So she sold it right before she died. When she was dying, she said, and it was one of the first things she said to me when she told me that she was about to die. She says, well, I'm going to be able to leave you an inheritance. And I thought this was kind of a bit ghoulish. And she said, you know, is this going to mean you'll have enough to write another book? And I sort of almost stupidly said, I'll use it to buy another house. Like, we've lost our house, I'll buy a house for Di and I, which is what we did. But I, you know, I remembered her saying, is it going to be enough for you to write another book? So I kept a little bit back so I could drop back to part-time at work, and I wrote this book, a book about her.
Yeah. What about the garden, Yanto? Is that still surviving?
So I'm told it was all kind of bulldozed and turned into two little townhouses. I try to pretend it's still there. Yeah, it's there in myth. And, you know, when I was writing this book and I'd wake up and I have my little study and I'd sit there on, you know, Fridays when I do my writing, and I would think very much about her gifting me this room and this space where I could do things like write a book, because I know that neither she or my grandparents ever got to do that, that they were always just working so much they never had the freedom to do those kind of things. But I can imagine my mother coming over now and saying, well, you don't have a garden and it's so tidy in here. You know, you should mess it up a bit. You do too much housework.
Here's some tissues and sand.
Yeah, here's some sand. Let's scatter that about. You need more dog hair in here.
When do you find yourself thinking about her now, Yanto?
When I think about the quality of my life now, I would not have this if I hadn't grown up with her. I mean, not just the material legacy of having somewhere lovely to live, but to grow up with somebody so strong and who had such a faith in their own will. After she died, I realised how much of that I'd inherited, and a lot of the ways of thinking she had and the outlook on the world. You know, she was remarkably good at not being angry about things, that even though she dealt with a lot of bigotry and bias, she didn't take it as personally as I think some people do. Yeah, I mean, I feel her presence quite palpably pretty much constantly.
Can you read me the poem she wrote about her garden that she wrote when you were just a baby?
So she wrote this poem, I think, just after she left my father, and she set up in a little rental place and she had her first garden unto herself that was all hers. And I found it after she died. So she wrote, today I planted an eggplant next to the capsicum. The garden grows homely as I settle down here alone. There's geranium, lavender, sage, thyme and nasturtium. Slowly I'm building a life of my own.
Yanto, I've really loved meeting your mum through you. Thank you so much for telling your story on Conversations.
Thank you.
Yanto Ware's book is called Mother and I, The Fable of a Willful Family. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.